I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. To get to the truth of the matter about Iran's missile attack on Israel and the larger implications for the Middle East and beyond, we have with us Dr. Elliot Cohen, CSIS Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy. Elliot Cohen, also, of course, a legendary policy man. Elliot, so glad to have you here to try to make sense of this. I guess the first and most critical question I have is, why now did Iran all of a sudden emerge from the shadows? No longer using proxies, but seeming, you know, just going straight forward at Israel. Why now?
First, thanks for the kind introduction. I think that's really the right question. And that highlights what's most important about this, which is not just that the missiles and so on were intercepted, which is obviously important, or the coalition that did it, also important, but why did they decide to be blatant? And I think there are really two things. One is, so the hit that they took in Syria was pretty dramatic. You know, they had the head of the Quds force for that part of the world, the head of their kind of paramilitary covert action force was killed together with a bunch of other senior officers. But I think if you step back and look at the bigger picture, there's been a kind of in the shadows war between Israel and Iran, which has been going on for some time. It's been growing more intense. And I think the Iranians have been emboldened by two things. First, the progress of their nuclear program. They're getting closer and closer to the point where they will have nuclear weapons. But I think they've also been encouraged by the tightening of their relationship with Russia and by them increasingly being in a coalition, which is anti-American, which also happens to be anti-Israel with the Russians, but also in a quieter way with the Chinese. And of course, the North Koreans is the fourth element in that. And I think from our point of view, that's the really important thing. I'll say one other thing, which is, you know, what happens whenever the Iranians do this, what they like to do is they like to push the margin of what they can do and what they can then get away with. And this is in some ways a textbook case of this. You know, they've launched this incredible barrage of over 300 missiles. Almost all of them get shot down or kind of blow up in midair or don't even get off the launch pad. Still, it's a big deal. And everybody's reaction is, okay, well, you know, this crisis is over. Let's stop this. We don't want any escalation.
Yeah, nothing. No harm. Nothing. No, didn't land on anybody.
Well, it did land on people.
One person,
One person in Israel, and I believe some people in Jordan, too. But, you know, it sets a precedent. And the Iranians have been quite brilliant in a way doing absolutely outrageous things and getting away with it. You know, I would note that Salman Rushdie just published a memoir called Knife about the attack on him at Chautauqua. I'd actually been on that stage 2 weeks before.
My uncle was there when it happened.
It was a horrifying attack. It left him blind in one eye and with a lot of other physical injuries. And, you know, they never paid a penalty for ordering the assassination of this famous author. And there have been other things that they've never paid a penalty for either.
Hamas, Hezbollah,
attack on a Jewish community center in Argentina. And so what they've always done is they've always been able to actually extend their room for maneuver because, you know, we always want to kind of revert to saying, okay, well, that's over and we don't have to deal with the problem anymore. The thing is they remain a very large problem and will continue to do so. I mean, it's a regime that's inveterately hostile to the Israelis, but it's also important to remember they are inveterately hostile to us.
Yeah, we're the great Satan. Israel's maybe the lesser Satan of the two. But I want to ask you, so, you know, you included China in that coalition, of course, and Israel and China haven't been on bad terms necessarily through the years. In fact, Israel's helped China with some things.
Yeah, the Chinese in general, you know, they have a very transactional view of things. I don't think they want to get involved in the thick of this. But what we can see in the Chinese relationship with Russia, and I think you also see it to some extent the relationship with Iran, is they certainly don't want to do anything to inhibit Iranian misbehavior. So the best example of that is the Houthis firing off missiles at merchant ships. The Chinese are not part of any coalition to defend these ships, certainly not to go after the people who are launching them. I don't believe there's any evidence that they've really been leaning on the Iranians, who after all are the Houthis' paymasters and the ones who provide them this kind of military hardware. They're content for us to do the heavy lifting on that sort of thing, while they get to cultivate relationships with the Iranians, but to some extent with everybody. So the Chinese are not particularly benign players in any of this. They're not as actively malevolent as the Russians or the Iranians are, but they're not constructive, let's put it that way. I mean, in the case of Ukraine, they're a lot worse than not being constructive.
So, Elliot, how much of this with Iran's boldness has to do with the fact that they continue to march towards a nuclear weapon, and it's accelerated now, now that the JCPOA has expired? The Biden administration tried to revive it unsuccessfully. How much does that have to do with this?
I think it has a lot to do with it, but let's remember the JCPOA was not a great deal to begin with. JCPOA, at the best, was going to kick the can down the road 10, 15 years. That's all. And furthermore, it didn't address any other element of Iran's malign behavior. And in fact, in some ways, by loosening up the sanctions and releasing money and so forth, actually made it more likely, I think, that Iran was going to misbehave. The critical question for the West has always been this. The Iranians are clearly determined to get a nuclear capability, possibly to actually get nuclear weapons. There's debate about that second point, certainly to get nuclear capability. The only way they're going to be stopped is if somebody decides to use force. And there's arguments on both sides of that. If you choose not to use force, you're going to be looking at a world with Iranian nuclear weapons.
And we'll have to live with it.
And you're going to have to live with it. And that is an unpalatable truth. And unfortunately, in international affairs, when people encounter an unpalatable truth, their deepest desire is to somehow avoid seeing it.
Thus kick the can down the road.
Right.
Okay. So where does this leave Iran and Israel right now? Israel's obviously contemplating a response. Israel has world opinion on its side on this one, at least for the moment, feels tenuous. But, you know, as you said, one of the important things that happened here was Israel had a coalition that helped defend it, including Saudi Arabia, including Jordan, including, I believe, Egypt. So this was an important moment for Israel, plus the United States and the UK.
Yeah. No, and France. No, it was a very important moment. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Israelis are taking a bit of time to think it through. It would be better if they took even more time. I just saw a report that the Iranians are pulling some of their operatives out of Syria. Of course, one of the logical counterstrokes for the Israelis would be to really seriously go after Iranian personnel in Syria, of which there are a lot, possibly Iranian personnel in Lebanon, of which there are quite a few, possibly Iranian personnel in Yemen as well. A direct attack on Iran, you know, certainly with aircraft or massive airstrikes, involves all kinds of problems because, among other things, you'd be overflying Arab states. And you'd be revealing quite a bit about your capabilities.
It's a long flight.
It's a long flight. You'd be really, but also, you know, you'd be doing the kinds of things that you would do if you ever really wanted to attack the nuclear program directly. And they probably don't want to reveal that just yet.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, in fact, as you point out in your current column in The Atlantic, Israeli humorists are saying, you know, this was the first direct flight from Tehran to Israel since 1979. So it really is a long flight. It's a long flight both in distance and in, you know, the obvious barriers.
You know, I think, you know, when you talk at the tactical level, you can never underestimate how clever the Israelis can get. And the Israelis could get quite clever and find some way that we don't, you know, we may not be thinking as much about. It could be, you know, a massive cyber attack. It could be something with cruise missiles. It could be attacks on Iranian shipping. I mean, there are a whole bunch of different possibilities that I think they will think about. The one further consideration for the Israelis, you know, at the moment they have this coalition. But, you know, looming over everything else is that they've got Hezbollah to their north with 150,000 rockets and missiles of different kinds. I think the Israelis do at some point feel that they will have to go after Hezbollah, but that'll be a much more difficult kind of campaign even than the one that they've waged in Gaza because they're very well dug in and, you know, they do have the ability to really hit Israeli cities. So we'll see. Now, I think on their side, the Iranians, you know, want to keep Hezbollah as the kind of ace in the hole to deter an attack on the nuclear program. So it's as I think often happens in the Middle East, it's this bizarre minuet that the actors dance with each other.
Right. And the dance continues. Israel, the question I also have is does Israel's internal politics, Netanyahu's leadership, how much does that play into these decisions that are being made now?
Well, it does. I mean, the Israelis are one of the reasons why they're in a difficult place is this is probably the worst, most divided leadership they've ever had, certainly in a period of national crisis since the creation of the state. You know, Bibi is somebody who nobody trusts, nobody likes, who is clinging onto power, even though his popularity rate is like 20% or something like that. And there's deep mistrust between him and the Minister of Defense, Gallant, and Benny Gantz, who's basically leader of the main opposition party, who's also part of this war cabinet.
I mean, you've got three Israeli leaders in the war cabinet who don't trust each other.
They don't trust each other at all. And that's just the beginning of what's actually a very complicated political picture. So I think that's difficult. The one thing that I would say is, at least in the past, which doesn't guarantee anything for the future, Bibi has always actually been, you know, he talks a lot and he talks a kind of a bold game. In practice, he's actually quite cautious, or he has been cautious. Now, you know, that could change, but I think he certainly has support in the cabinet and in the Israeli public for doing something. How big is something? That's a somewhat different question.
You know, years ago, our friend Jeff Goldberg wrote that Bibi's obsession is really Iran, that his father's obsession was chronicling the Spanish Inquisition. His brother, of course, was the, you know, Israeli hero at Entebbe and martyr. But Bibi, Jeff Goldberg wrote, wasn't as obsessed with Iran and thinks of them as Israel's ancient enemy, Amalek. Is Bibi hell-bent on destroying Iran? You mentioned
well,
he's cautious.
I mean, don't think the Israelis have they're not going to destroy Iran. I think they'd like to see, I mean, remember the Iranians were also one of their closest partners before the revolution.
Sure.
And they haven't forgotten that. You know, I think he, like everybody else, would like to see the regime go away, but I don't think that they see a path to making that happen. And he's not being irrational. I mean, nuclear weapons in the hands of a state that is really unqualifiedly determined to rub them off the face of the map, that's an existential threat. And so he's not being irrational. I think the problem is that he always felt that he could milk that perfectly reasonable and justifiable concern into his popularity at home and leverage on the Americans to do the things he would like the Americans to do. But at the end of the day, whether he has the gumption to then push through a really mammoth strike on Iran is not clear. Of course, you know, it's not at all clear that how much damage the Israelis could do in simply operating on their own, as you know, unlike us. And the other thing is there is in these matters in Israel a kind of collective decision making. And, you know, there's a war cabinet and you have to get the agreement of the war cabinet, and I'm not sure everybody would agree to something like that. It's not a presidential system.
So how does this all figure into the equation of the ongoing struggle at hand in Gaza? Israel seems to be pulling back a bit from certainly not going into Rafah, even though the threat is there. The hostage situation remains abysmal. I think we're on almost 200 days now that they've been captured. We don't even know how many of them are alive. Hamas says they don't really know where everybody is, i.e. they don't know who's alive, I guess. What now?
Who knows? I think the Israelis feel that they've done a great deal of damage to Hamas. That is not the same Hamas that existed on October 6th. They've obviously, you know, traumatized Palestinian society. The casualties are civilian casualties are probably not what Hamas reports, because among other things, Hamas doesn't report combatants killed or wounded.
Right, and whenever you hear it's the Gaza Health Ministry, it's Hamas.
Yeah, I mean, it's that they are Hamas, but they're also, first, it's very hard to actually count how many people get killed in the middle of a war. But even if that overall number was correct, you'd have to ask, well, how many of those were combatants, A, and how many of those people, you know, there's a mortality rate in any population, how many of those people would have been passing anyway? It's clear a lot of civilians were killed. I mean, I don't want to diminish that. I think there's been a lot of pressure put on the Israelis not to go into Rafah in a really big way. And I'm not entirely sure that they want to. I think it was clear that they always envisaged that there'd be this period of intense combat, which they've gone through. And then it would be a period of just continual raids and sort of preemptive attacks. And I think that's where we are now. And I think what you may see is incursions into Rafah, but they won't be the kinds of things that you saw in Gaza City or Khan Yunis. And so it'll be nonstop. I mean, what the Israelis are not going to revert to, I think, with Gaza is going to be a provocative incident and the Israelis respond. I think it'll be whenever they see a chance to land a blow without causing what the Israelis deem to be excessive civilian damage, they will do that.
Right. So you're talking about targeted assassinations of Hamas officials.
Yeah, assassinations, but also very large-scale raids. I mean, you know, they may be brigade-sized. I mean, at the height of this operation, the Israelis had 5 divisions operating in Gaza. That's a very, very large force. I think they now have a couple of brigades in the Gaza Strip, if that. And you may see raids up to that level. So not, a couple of people fast roping down helicopters in the middle of the night, but, operations which might involve a couple of thousand soldiers, but are still not the same thing as, massive armored forces moving into densely urbanized area. Also, I'm sure that part of what they're thinking is that over time, a lot of the refugee population or internally displaced population that's in the Rafah area displaces back north to their original homes in Gaza or Khan Yunis.
One of the things I think isn't reported enough in Western media and U.S. media is the disruption to Israeli society,
yep.
The disruption to the economy, the disruption to Israel's, amazing culture of innovation.
Yep.
How does all of that play into Israel's need to destroy Hamas?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the internally displaced person issue. I mean, there are different...
Meaning the Israelis that had to move south because right. of Hezbollah and the Israelis that had to move north because of Hamas.
The Israelis have basically moved any of their population that was within about 7 kilometers of the border south. That doesn't sound like a lot, but actually it was a pretty densely populated area. So you have something on the order of 100,000 civilians who've been displaced.
You have internal refugees.
Who are essentially internal refugees in various places. You had the same thing in Gaza. Some of those people are coming back. Some of those people will never come back and will settle in other parts of the country. But that area is going to be normalized. But the north is not. And I don't think the Israeli there's a very old statement by David Ben-Gurion, once said, either we go to the border or the border comes to us.
Yeah.
And so, which is why he was always very much in favor of, you settle land right up to the border, you cultivate fields right up to the border, and you don't let the other side feel that they can push you back. And I think that for the Israelis is the key thing. I mean, they've gone through hard times before. It's a very resilient country. The business sector is actually tremendously resilient as well. You don't have people fleeing the country, far from it.
A lot less tourism.
Although they're between evangelicals and American Jews. There are a lot of people going there.
Right.
And it's,
do you think they'll even go now after this Iranian barrage? Do you think that they'll continue to go?
Yeah. Yeah, I think – it'd probably be a different matter if there had been hundreds of people killed in barrages of rockets falling on cities. But if, it's a night or two in a bomb shelter, people can live with that.
Elliot, some people and, critics of the administration, critics of allies even, have said, they're not taking this Iranian threat seriously enough. Iran just launched 300 missiles at Israel. That's unprecedented. Imagine if anyone launched 300 missiles at the United States or the UK or France or Germany, or you could go on and on.
Yeah.
Is the world taking this seriously enough?
No, but nobody takes things really seriously until it happens to you. I mean, the Israelis didn't take Ukraine particularly seriously. And, I remember some pretty heated arguments with Israeli friends on an earlier trip when I was saying you should be taking Ukraine seriously. And they said, why? I said, because when barrages of missiles begin falling on your cities, you're going to want other people to take it seriously. Unfortunately, this is just human nature. I mean, if You know, if we're sitting here in Washington, D.C., if somebody had fired over 300 missiles at Washington, D.C., even if all the missiles had been shot down, I dare say that the mayor and the residents of Washington would have been saying, okay, we got to do, it's not enough to say we shot down the missiles.
I mean, you'd have old guys like me and you trying to enlist if something like that
happened. Yeah, of course. I mean, but that's true. That's true of any country.
Yeah.
And so I it's not particularly surprising. I think the unfortunate thing is we are living in a period where there are a number of really major threats to Western security. Russia, very much one of them. China, another. Iran, a third. To that, I'd probably add the sort of secular, the not secular, far from it, kind of the Sunni jihadist movements. And they, you know, figuring out how to handle them is really hard, and it requires lots and lots of resources, a lot more than we're willing to spend at the moment. And so, you know, we're doing what human beings often do in those cases, which is you try to define the problem away and, you know, you cover your eyes with your hands and say, I can't see what you're talking about.
Do we have a good sense of what more Iran could do along the lines of this attack that they just waged?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think the shooting down of particularly of the ballistic missiles coming in, that was quite a remarkable technical feat. And I think that was made possible by networking of all kinds of different sensors, a layered air defense system, but above all, good intelligence about what they have, what those things are capable of. Well, that's the kind of intelligence that we're really good at. And, you know, I doubt that they have any super weapons. You know, it, this is war, so they will always be innovating and creating and adapting. What we probably have a less good handle on is what kind of covert action, sabotage, assassination, that sort of stuff they might try to pull off. But the, you know, we've never really taken our eye off the ball in terms of Iran as a threat, say, to, you know, the navigation in the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, we're interacting with them all the time.
So if you're heading the National Security Council right now, or if you're, as you were, senior counselor at State Department, what are you counseling the president and the secretary right now with this equation?
I think the biggest thing that I would be saying to them is it's a mistake to think about this in narrow terms. First, in the case of Iran, this is a long-term issue or set of problems. And in fact, you know, I did deal with this when I was at State. Was, you know, the Iranians were killing and wounding a lot of American kids in Iraq with explosively formed projectile IEDs, a particularly lethal form of IED.
When the U.S. was fighting in Iraq.
And we really did nothing about it. And I remember being infuriated at the time. And for a whole bunch of reasons, we decided we're not going to pay attention to this because it's covert. And I'd say this is the fruit of what happens when you do that. But the other thing I would say is we have to realize that we're dealing not with a single separable problem here, but a whole bunch of related problems. And we've got to think of them as part of one big problem. The metaphor I use in the or the analogy, rather, that I use in the Atlantic piece is in the same way that it was a mistake for European and American decision makers in the 1930s to say, well, you know, Mussolini invading Ethiopia, that's one problem. Hitler occupying the Rhineland or invading Austria, that's another problem. The Japanese launching a war against China in Manchuria in 1937, that's a third problem. No, they were actually one really big problem, and that's why we ended up in one really big war. And I think the, you know, what I would try, being trying to do is to get them to think holistically and with as wide an aperture as possible. And people don't like doing that because when you do that, first, the, you know, the resources you need seem daunting, and we are underspending. We're not willing to, at the moment, to devote the resources we need, but the problems also become intellectually very challenging. How do you, you know, what's the priority? What are the linkages that you go after?
What are the options?
What are the options? It's all very difficult. But I, you know, my basic view is that's no excuse.
Elliot, as always, so much to think about. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.